I'm Darren Davidson, and this is Kootenai Morning. Well, you know, you may have heard the famous phrase, "The medium is the message." That was back in 1964. Canadian communication theorist Marshall McLuhan came up with the term in his book called Understanding Media, The Extensions of Man. Well, I think what McLuhan was predicting was that one day in the future, spoiler alert, that's now, the way in which we receive media information would in fact become more important than the message of media itself. So you just got to look around your cell phone, your laptop, all the platforms out there like Facebook, TikTok, Twitter. Blaine Cook is a Nelson resident who's been in the middle of the digital media revolution for the last 20 years through some of its most fascinating days, right up to today's Twitter headlines, which we'll have to talk about, Blaine. You've had a remarkable career that's landed you jobs at Twitter. You were founding engineer there, the Condé Nast magazine empire, and the new Mastodon platform, which was making some waves. Blaine joins us today. Thanks, buddy, for being here.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
So you live right here in town, eh?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I got to ask you right off the bat, how the heck did a guy with so much interesting international experience end up living right here in Uphill?
I grew up in the Kootenays, all over BC, really. So it's really coming home for me. So that's the long and short of it. I was living abroad and was out here when COVID hit. And so that kind of forced the issue because it had been a long time in planning, but I could never commit. And so that helped me out quite a lot.
I get the feeling that actually happened to quite a few people who ended up stuck here and thought, oh, nice place to be stuck.
Yeah, totally.
But you're a British Columbian. You had said your dad worked for the Overweighty chain.
Yeah, that's
which
right.
Which is about
that's
as DC right. as it gets. Right. So you grew up in a lot of fairly blue-collar rural dispatches like across BC.
Yeah, up north, Terrace, Sparwood, Lower Mainland, everywhere. So done the tour.
Locals may have read your story in the Nelson Star. Tyler Harper did a great job on that last month. They may have seen your name in other pieces, though. You've been covered in Slate, the New York Times, Forbes. First off, you call yourself a socio-technologist. I'd never heard of that before. It seems very apt. What exactly do you do?
Yeah. If anyone can tell me, let me know. In theory, I'm a programmer, so I write software for computers, but I actually did sociology in university, like every good technologist, I dropped out two classes from graduating. But
almost there, that's great.
But I really care about, you know, the social impact of computers and technology and like what can computers do for us and how can we use them to you know do things better. So in my day job it's sort of a mix of like some programming and then a lot of kind of trying to convince people to do things better. Mm-hmm. Really. Mm-hmm. So it's whether it's in terms of the internet standards, so that's some of the Mastodon stuff, like building better ways to build the system, so tools for programmers, essentially.
It couldn't be a better time for the world for more socio-technologists, it seems. Yeah. Technology has become so omnipotent, hasn't
it? Yeah.
Can you give us I don't know if a highlight reel is possible here, Blaine. Like I say, it's quite an impressive career arc, but can you give us an idea of how you got started back about 20 or so years ago and bring us right up to where you are with your latest project now?
Sure, yeah.
And there's no rush. Take your time.
So I started out sort of in university working on like kind of activist-y nonprofit projects, so doing tech for those sorts of projects. So I worked with the Wilderness Committee.
Right.
I worked with a group called Indie Media and DAO.ca, which were like early activist online internet media sort of sites, I guess, networks. And, you know, it's interesting because back then, the rallying cry, the revolutionary cry was "Be the media," because back in those days,
that's right, that's right. That's what we thought we were going to be.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And you couldn't be the media back then. It was like, you know, all the big corporate publishers and everything were the media, and if you weren't that, if you weren't a quote unquote reporter, mm-hmm. you didn't have a voice in public other than like a letter to the editor, maybe.
Right. Right.
So that was sort of the starting point. And then, I, much to my chagrin, I got offered a job in San Francisco with actually the first podcasting startup called Odeo.
Okay, so, that's what Odeo. Yeah, okay, I saw that in some of the background last night.
Yeah, so we built the first podcast site. Probably 15 years too early.
Wow, way ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was my sort of first corporate job, although it was just like a 5-person startup. But it didn't go very well. And so in about a year and a half in, we're like, this isn't working out. We should try something else. Mm-hmm. And so we tried a bunch of experiments. And one of those experiments was Twitter. So that became a thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so worked at Twitter for a few years, built that sort of from the ground up. Along the way, I mentioned the internet standard stuff, so I built some internet standards. So probably the most well-known one is this thing called OAuth, which is if you've ever used sign-in with Google, like that button that you see on the internet, or like it actually happens all over the place that you don't really see it, but mm-hmm. It's how we do authentication on the internet. So
make sure you are who you are.
Exactly.
Before you enter any program.
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Right. So I started that project, and after I left Twitter, that worked on that for a while in the sort of internet standards minds. And then stopped working on that stuff because just burned out pretty hard on that. It's a lot of politics. It's basically like being a politician, but with a bunch of nerds that have no training in being politicians.
Not a whole lot of diplomatic.
Yeah, exactly. So I started a startup building called Poetica, building editorial tools for writers.
Right. I saw that, but being a writer myself, I wonder if that's mm-hmm. what Poetica, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it was, I still don't think we have good tools for writers. Collaboration and word track changes brings sadness and fear into the hearts of every writer.
Spell check in general is a frightening thing, isn't it? Yeah. This platform was for communication between folks within the industry, or it was actually a tool to help you work more proficiently.
Yeah, it was sort of really focused around like how do we build. How can writers communicate? So writers and editors, when they're working together, mm-hmm. it's a conversation. It's sort of like, the expressiveness of a pen, like a red pen on a piece of paper is incredible. And I think our digital tools really let people down. I don't think they're very good at allowing people to communicate their intent. And so we end up mediating between these really poor interfaces. Mm-hmm. So that was an attempt to do that. We got so far and realized that we were going to be essentially corporate salespeople, mm-hmm. just selling our product mm-hmm. everywhere. Mm-hmm. So we ended up selling that to Condé Nast.
Right.
So that's how I ended up there.
That's it. People who don't know Condé Nast, it is the giant parent company that owns so many of the magazines that you see at your shopping store rack. We'll talk about that just in a second.
Yeah.
Did we cover most of it, or are we still?
Yeah, I think that's pretty much it. And just recently, so I was at Condé for 5 or 6 years, and just recently I've joined a kind of applied research company out of Vancouver.
Right.
And we're working on some pretty cool future internet stuff.
So and what's the name of that company? That's top.
Called, yeah, it's called Fission.
Right. Top. Yeah. That's top item on your mm-hmm. on your LinkedIn. Yeah. Yeah. So so the elephant in the room. This is surreal, Orwellian, laughable, comical. What's going on at Twitter right now? Let's start with that journey. What was the platform meant to be? What has it become? And where did it go wrong? Particularly with the whole Trump content moderation thing really came to light. Where did it go around? Like, what's your opinion on where this massively potentially good but not very good thing is going right now?
For sure. I think in the early days, to go back to that, like, be the media. Sort of thing. Twitter was really revolutionary because it just lowered the barrier. We knew, we had that moment of blogging where blogging happened, and that was part of the indie media stuff mm-hmm. and all of that. It became easier to publish.
Right.
And then with Twitter, it just became trivial. Mm-hmm. So now everyone's a publisher. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an incredible, sort of emancipatory kind of thing. But the problem is that, you know, with Twitter, and I think this is true of Facebook and a bunch of other of these big internet companies, it turns out that one company controlling the speech of 400 million people is not a great idea. Yeah. and so, you know, like, I think the moderation question was always a really hard one for Twitter, because, you know, people try to apply this sort of governmental human rights idea of freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that doesn't work in communities, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you can't go into Oso Negro and start spouting off stuff and, you know, strip down. And, you know, I'm sure lots of people would like to, but they're going to get kicked out. Mm-hmm. And but the problem is we ended up with this space where Twitter was the global monopoly. And if you wanted to have a voice, you had to be there. Mm-hmm. And so kicking you out meant that they meant like cutting off your voice.
Right.
And so it's this tension. And there's not really a good answer to that within sort of the corporate monopoly world, is in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So basically, big business took the business interest, the sort of lizard brain capitalism that these players have,
exactly,
took over and said, "Wow, man, we can just make money."
Exactly. Yeah. Right. And they have to, right? Like there's no way out of that intellectual trap.
It's a bit of a trap.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
I had a bigger question here asking about Elon Musk, and you know, he seems to be wanting to build. He seems to want to build Twitter into sort of his vision of Tesla and SpaceX. We could probably talk for hours about this guy. I see the latest news is he's in trouble with his creditors as of this morning. We were talking about last night.
I think the thing with Elon is that he's got so much
money
and hubris.
And
it doesn't, you know, like, I think it's crazy, literally crazy, to think that you could be in charge of something like that. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, mm-hmm, this is the scale of problem that we have, governments and, you know, gigantic organizations that are designed to regulate and run and all of these kinds of things. And he's like, "Oh, I'll just walk in and I'm so smart that I can do all of this."
It's like, it's like walking into the Vatican saying, I think I can handle this Pope gig.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's just not possible.
Have you met
Elon. No. I've met David Sachs, but yeah.
Is he a good guy? Because I remember when Tesla first started, I was like, "Hey, he's like a David Suzuki with a ton of money. He actually could make a difference and you know, make cash for people so that they buy into this." Is he?
As it turns out, it sounds like Tesla, a lot of that is a lot of the economic force behind Tesla, mm-hmm, was basically trading carbon credits.
Right.
So
right.
Other companies didn't want to make electric cars, and they could get carbon credits in order to avoid making electric cars.
A little bit of a shell game.
Yeah. So I think he's a capitalist and not. That's not good for the world.
The image he has projected of himself is that he's a real technocrat. He's a very sharp dude. He really is the money guy. Mm. He was not the brains behind these operations. He brought the cash. And where did he make the money in the first place?
Emerald mines in South Africa from his family.
Is that right?
I did not know that. Yeah.
I think we got a headline from Monday's news package. Emerald mines.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
So yeah.
And then he flipped that into other investments.
Yeah. Yeah. And he was early in at PayPal. So he had a company that bought PayPal and made a lot of money off of that and kind of just kept rolling it over. And like, some of the things are super interesting and, you know, SpaceX is actually kind of incredible, but there are a lot of smart people who work at SpaceX. It wasn't like Elon Musk just building rockets in his backyard. It was, you know, he had this basic idea and enabled a lot of that stuff. That's great.
And they had the emerald cash and all those bags of emeralds.
Yeah.
If you're just tuning in, everybody, we're speaking with Blaine Cook, who is a local fella, a socio-technologist.